Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast that lets you know everything you need to see on streaming. Today, I've got with me our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Been a while since we've chatted to you, Jack.
Yeah, it's been ages.
I know. So welcome back. This week, we'll be chatting to Gael Garcia Bernal about his new film, Emma, and reviewing that. And we'll be looking at The Assistant and the new Netflix series, Hollywood. And we'll be testing your Tinseltown brains with a quiz. But first, boys, shall we answer a question from a reader?
Let's do it.
It's a romantic one. If you could be in an on-screen romance, which one would it be? Jack.
Well, mine would probably be Aragorn and Erwin from Lord of the Rings, because then you get to go on this amazing adventure as Aragorn, which would be me, obviously.
Yes.
Glad you clarified.
Yeah.
But you would look lovely in a dress, so...
Yeah, and I'd get to be king, and then I would get to live out my life with an attractive elf, which, you know, just sounds like the dream.
Right now, that does, living with an attractive elf.
You'd have a luxuriant beard as well.
I could do that, especially because my Corona beard that you guys haven't seen because I shaved it off before this was awful. I would very much like to be able to grow a real beard.
What about you, Jordan?
I'm going to choose Blue Valentine. No, I'm only kidding. That would be horrific.
Wear those really terrible glasses that Ryan Gosling does and have really bleak sex in a motel.
Yeah, let's not do that. I'm going to be a total cliche for anyone who knows me and pick Hicks and Aliens. Because A, I'd be romantically involved with the galaxy's biggest badass, Ellen Ripley. For our first date, I'd get to teach her how to use a pulse rifle with grenade launcher. That'd be pretty sweet. Also, it's a tragically unrequited romance. They never actually hook up. As we all know, all the best on-screen romances are unrequited. I mean, the fact I'm dead before the title sequence of the
next film is a bit rubbish.
But
this is choosing a pretty hardcore romance.
But I'm not counting Alien 3 as canon, so I imagine a brighter future after Aliens. We'd go and live happily ever after with you. It'd be great.
Okay, brilliant. I want to be Elio or Oliver in Call Me By Your Name.
Speaking of cliches.
I'm probably going to go with Oliver, and then I won't have to do something horrible to a peach. but I would really like to have had their summer romance and lived in that lovely house and cycled around in Italy. And, you know, it's all set in Bergamo and Crema, which at the moment is sort of the epicenter for Italy. And that seems like a lovely reminder of what it was like when it was just pasta and drinking and discos and swimming in the river and all of that sort of stuff. And also, it just seemed like a really passionate romance. And again, like you, Jordan, I know that's going to end badly with my heart broken. I'll either be on a train out of there or crying on my mum's shoulder in a car. But... better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. So that's mine.
I think I was thinking more about the future than you guys. You were just short-term romance here.
We're in the moment.
Yeah,
burn, all about the passion.
Yeah, burn bright and hard and then gone. That's what I want. Okay, so shall we move on? Shall we have a look at this week's releases? Let's have a look at the new film from Pablo Larraín, starring his longtime collaborator, Gael Garcia Bernal.
Vamos a estar bien tú y yo, ¿no?
Estamos bien.
¿Sí?
Sí, estamos bien, no necesitamos nada, la gente nos quiere.
Sí.
Vaya a volver con tu hijo, ¿verdad? Es lo correcto, ¿verdad? Por supuesto. Si necesitáis que cometamos un crimen, me llaman. Vamos a estar cerca.
That's Emma. And before we talk about this film, let's listen to what Gael Garcia Bernal had to say when you talked to him, Jordan, earlier this week. What was that like? You were doing it remotely, obviously. Was it a good chat?
Yeah, it was my first time doing a remote chat with an actor, and a little bit of insider info. He didn't have his video feed on, so I can only assume that he was having a terrible hair day or something. But he was
otherwise, I don't think that's possible. Yeah.
I mean, he has got amazing hair.
I just think he didn't want you nosing around his kitchen or his bedroom or wherever he was zooming from.
It's probably more likely. Otherwise, he was great. He was, very, very fun, very revealing. Thought it was a good chat.
Okay. So what did you start by asking him?
So I started by asking him about his character, Gaston, and how he fits into the film's narrative.
Gaston is this very successful choreographer that organized a dance company in Valparaíso, in Chile, which is a wonderful city. The film begins with a couple living the horrible consequences that come after a failed adoption. Failed adoption is when the the adoption is returned, no? The adoptee is returned. It is not a very common thing that can happen, but it happens everywhere in the world. And, you know, it excited me to do this film also because it was going to deal with an issue that I think I haven't seen films about that, about failed adoptions and about how things get shake up, you know, in the couple and everything. So my character is from the nuclear family that they want to form. He's the, let's say, the father, and the mother is Emma, who is a dancer in the dance company, and she's the main character and the main person that we all circle around.
Your character Gaston and Emma, they have this very sort of complicated relationship, one clearly based in love, but they can be sort of shockingly cruel to each other at times. I mean, do you think the two of them are actually good for each other?
I think they are. I think they really love each other. They are capable of, you know, supporting each other in their artistic journeys. It is clearly what we see in the film. You know, we see a kind of a new cycle of the relationship, an old cycle ending and a new beginning. So I don't know if they'll end up together, maybe not.
We should say that Marianne, who plays Emma, she's a remarkable dancer.
Yes.
And there's a lot of sort of visually stunning kind of expressionistic dance sequences in the film. But I have to say, Gael, I was disappointed not to see you strut your stuff. Did you petition Pablo to add a scene where Gaston slips on his dancing shoes and shows his millennials how it's done?
I would have loved to do it, to dance, because it's something I love doing it. But the thing is that, you know, it is a common thing. You never see choreographers dance. That's something that also Pablo wanted to establish as well. I mean, how do you know who's the choreographer? Well, the one that doesn't dance.
Obviously, you were surrounded by dancers for much of the shooting, I must imagine. Was there much dancing on set between takes? I imagine they must have been dancing just to keep busy while setups were happening around them.
Yes, absolutely. We were warming up, and they were the ones that kind of like led the warm-up whilst the lights and camera were setting and everything. We would be there and we would be doing these moves for like half an hour, you know, and it was wonderful, man. It was like really powerful because we were a lot of people as well. I don't know, the dance company is a real dance company that has like 60 people or something like that, or even more. So it is a lot of people that were there, you know, doing it, and it felt really good. And it felt daunting at the beginning, of course, because you're there with a lot of professionals, but then you just have to let go and go for it.
Well, that sounds amazing. This is your third time working with Pablo Larraín, following No in 2012 and Neruda in 2016. Clearly, you love working together. How has your working relationship changed or evolved over the years since you started working together?
Oh, man, it's great because there's a lot of communication that goes on verbally and non-verbally as well. I mean, we're always kind of like on the same boat. And what's interesting about working with Pablo is that he goes off on a like poetic expedition whilst working on a film, you know. He wanders into some world that kind of is very contestatory and at the same time explores and at the same time it doesn't have the words for it, and you're there by his side in a way, or listening to him and wondering and thinking, okay, I think I might know what's going on here. Okay, let's try something. And so he invites you to try things. I guess I became more daring now. I mean, obviously, trusting him completely, but also maturing as an actor as well. I think I became a little bit more kind of like, I'll just go for it. And if we fail, we fail, you know, but we have to try things. When we did Emma, what was very surprising is that it was the first time for many of us, we had worked with a lot of people that are 25 years old. And that was a big surprise because there is a big change in the references, you know, like we don't share the same references at all. You know, we don't share many things that the cultural, you know, aspects that we kind of like grab from. I don't know. It was very exciting and at the same time, really encouraging as well, mm-hmm. because they were so brave, so talented, you know, fearless. And they pushed us to be even bolder, you know. I don't know, Mariana is a fantastic actress. She's great, and she was really going for it, you know, all the way. It was wonderful.
Yeah, sounds amazing. I don't want to make you feel old, Gael, but incredibly, it's 20 years since your first feature, Amores Perros, which was obviously also the feature debut of Alejandro González Iñárritu as well. What are your sort of memories of making that film? It must hold a special place in your heart.
Yeah, because we did it, we actually shot it in 1999. So it was right before the century. And I was very young, I was 19. It was a whole different world, of course. The expectations of where cinema could get you or the way that cinema could travel were completely different from what they are now. It is a film that I hardly knew what was going on whilst making it. I didn't understand how cinema worked, you know, I didn't understand the process. So I was very, you know, concentrated in the character, in the working with the actors, you know, and training with the animals, thinking that this was going to be an opportunity that was, you know, it was going to come and then go, because there wasn't such a thing as like a Mexican film industry. It was very destroyed, you know, by that point. So I don't know, it felt a completely different, I felt in another skin in a way. But what's nice is that about cinema is that no matter what, you know, you leave a piece of yourself in the film. And so I see the film and I see myself at that age. And obviously there's things I don't like about me at that age, you know, but at the same time, there's other things that are very surprising and fun about seeing me thinking that I knew what I was doing, but I clearly wasn't.
And before I let you go, Gael, I have to ask you about Coco, Pixar's Coco, which I'm sure is being watched on repeat in homes across the world right now that a lot of schools are closed. How often do you find yourself humming or singing Remember Me? Because that song has barely left my head in the 3 years since I first saw that film.
Every night, once in a while, and I actually have to hold you responsible now, because today my whole day is going to be based on that.
So, oh no, I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay, but it happens a lot because little kids, you know, when I'm walking on the streets or something, they sing Remember Me, and so
it's a beautiful song, so it's not the worst song to have stuck in your head.
Exactly.
That's cool. Gael Garcia Bernal, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed that chat, Jordan. I'm glad you got in the Coco reference, because Coco is a massive film in my household and I would sing that song to him if I saw him walking down the street. What did you think of Emma?
I really liked it. As Gael Garcia Bernal said in our interview, I don't think I've seen a film tackle parenthood and, you know, the abandonment of responsibility in quite this way before. Obviously, you see a lot of films about bad parenting, but it almost feels like a taboo subject for a story to tackle, like two parents basically handing their child back to an adoption agency, almost like it's a defective product or something. And the fact that the adoptive parents are this, you know, hedonistic couple who make a living out of dancing the reggaeton means you have certain assumptions about them that they're, you know, an irresponsible pair, which don't necessarily prove to be true. What I also really liked about it was it has a very odd structure in that it seems quite rambling and you don't quite know where it's going. Mm-hmm. Like Emma and Gaston, they have a lot of arguments throughout the film, but they sort of separate for a time and Emma goes off with a variety of partners throughout the rest of the film. And she's encountering all these people and you don't quite know why and where it's heading and where it's going, but I thought it all came together really nicely at the end in a way that was quite surprising and subversive, but also quite cool and interesting.
Yeah. Did you like it, Jack?
Yeah, I did enjoy it. It was a very twisted take on, you know, relationships and the way people are. Very new age type of romance with, you know, multiple partners and this leading character, Emma. The film is mesmerized by her, and so are we, as we kind of watch her go around flirting with all these people, and it is intoxicating. She's intoxicating, and you can understand why these characters fall in love with her, but she almost has this arrogance about her as well.
Yeah.
She's such an interesting character. I loved the dancing scenes as well. I thought they just looked fantastic, especially the stuff at the very beginning where we have the more classical music that the dance team are kind of moving to with this big light in the background. It's almost, you know, sci-fi-esque type sequence.
I loved the cinematography in this film. I thought it just made Valparaiso in Chile look wonderful and like a place I really wanted to go. So I love that sort of escapism aspect of it. But yeah, the dancing is amazing. And I also love this idea that here's a character, a female character, who is completely unapologetic about who she is, how she behaves, her sexual mores, what she wants, what she doesn't want. And that's quite refreshing to see. And even the way she sort of presented visually, like she's a femme fatale in as much as she seduces loads of different people, but she wears sort of grungy tracksuits. She's got this very peculiar hair. It's not classic sort of beauty that we might, in inverted commas, think of as a beautiful femme fatale. So I love that they were sort of playing with expectations with that. And I also love the fact there's this sort of secondary narrative running that's her as a pyromaniac. Not to give any spoilers, but, you know, there's an incident that sort of triggers this child being given back to the authorities. And you question all the way through that, like, who actually was responsible for that? But there's some beautiful shots of her sort of firing off this flamethrower in sort of these darkened streets. She is sort of like a human torch herself, isn't she? She sort of, everything she touches burns and crackles, and but it's too hot for any of the people that encounter her to handle. So I just loved it. I thought it was really beautiful and interesting and surprising. Gael Garcia Bernal, it's quite a different role for him as well, didn't you think?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen him do anything quite like this before. He almost feels emasculated around Emma just because she's such a dominating and striking figure. You almost can't imagine these two having a kind of relationship together. You can't see them fit together, but I did genuinely believe that there was this underpinning of love between them, even though they're in this, you know, caustic, adversarial relationship for a lot of the film, where they're just screaming, shouting and saying the most awful, horrible things to each other. Yeah, I still bought them as a loving couple.
They make quite a big point about them being 12 years apart and how, I guess, classically, you would think that the man in that relationship would be more dominating. He's a choreographer in it. He kind of directs the other dancers, but she's very much in control of the situation as well. It's an interesting dynamic that I feel like I haven't really seen before.
Yeah. Did it make you want to go to Chile?
Yeah, definitely. Especially because I've been stuck indoors for months.
Like, I know.
Anywhere looks appealing now, but especially a place as beautiful as El Paraiso.
It did make me worry about women with flamethrowers, though. And I was wondering when the police were going to catch up with her.
Yeah, it just seemed to be something that explains her sort of emotions rather than necessarily reality. There didn't seem to be anyone stopping her from torching cars in the street. You know, you would think someone would be ringing, you know, the police immediately having seen someone doing that, but obviously that didn't happen because it's sort of a fairy tale, isn't it? It's very much a sort of mesmerizing, sort of intoxicating fever dream of a sort of film. So reality doesn't really creep into it, does it?
I thought that was what was so interesting about the dance sequences, because obviously some of them you're supposed to take that they're literally happening, but I thought that a lot of them just felt like they were, you know, a representation of her emotional state at that point in the film, in the narrative. And it's amazing how much you can get just from the way someone's moving their body. Like, you can read so much into how they're feeling and what's going on in their heads at that point. I thought that was all incredibly well done.
Yeah, and the lighting is lovely as well, isn't it? There's like beautiful greens or yellows or reds that sort of seem to speak to how she's feeling as well.
There was the use of the soundtrack that I found interesting, because obviously we kind of see she kind of overtakes her lover's personality in a way, and we also hear like more and more reggaetron comes into the soundtrack as well. I for one very much dislike reggaetron, but it was really interesting to see how they kind of molded it into the more classical score as well. And then suddenly you would have these really kind of thumping scenes with lots of like big beats and stuff.
If you don't like reggaeton, you must have loved the scene in the middle where Gael just unloads on it as a genre.
Yeah, just picks it apart and tells her everything that's wrong with her choice of music. It's a great scene. I really enjoyed that, because it was that power dynamic, him trying to ascertain some control over this woman that was slipping through his fingers, and he thought by saying this stuff and sort of discrediting her passion was the way to do it. It's a really great scene, but it's quite funny as well.
Yeah, and then she just totally undercuts it by doing something very simple but so humiliating for him.
Yes.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting comment, I guess, on like the generational differences. I was reading an interview with the director where he was saying that she's the new generation of kids and teenagers and 20-year-olds who are kind of coming through, and they're very much more open with their relationships. And I guess I'm more related to Gael's character, which I don't know what that says about me, because he is, you know, basically cuckolded in this movie. But it was just seeing that transition from the old to the new. I thought it was quite interesting, and it was like a new take on younger generations, and I imagine we'll see more of that in cinema kind of coming forward, especially now that I guess filmmakers are probably watching more TikToks and things like that now that we're all in isolation.
Yep. So Yeah, you could imagine that Emma would be on TikTok doing her moves and just looking fierce. Okay, so we're going to highly recommend that for streaming. So where can people see this, Jordan?
Emma's available on the 2nd of May on Mubi, and there's also going to be a free preview screening, which is available from 12 a.m. GMT on the 1st of May.
Brilliant. Get to it. Okay, shall we move on to some uncomfortable viewing?
Welcome. Have a seat. Whatever's going on, you can tell me. That's what I'm here for. You're relatively new to the company.
I mean, I've been working here for nearly 2 months.
And you're under a lot of stress. Entry-level jobs in this industry are tough, right? Long hours? First one in, last one out.
Good night.
You're smart. You have to be smart. It's a tough job, but I can see that you've got what it takes.
So that's The Assistant. Jordan, tell us what it's about.
This stars Julia Garner, who you may recognize from Grandma, the 2015 film, or the Netflix series Ozark, which she's in at the moment. She plays Jane. She's the junior assistant of a sort of Harvey Weinstein-esque media mogul, film mogul. And the entire film is basically a day in the life depiction of what it's like to work in one of these oppressively toxic office environments. You know, the film opens sort of in the middle of the night or possibly very early morning. Jane is the first person into the office. She tidies up, she orders breakfast. She does all the sorts of menial tasks you would expect the janitor or cleaning staff to do. And then, you know, by 9 a.m. or so, her two sort of fellow male assistants casually stroll into the office and sit at their desks, seemingly without a care in the world because, you know, they've been there longer and they know that shit rolls downhill. So, and then everything that happens to Jane over the course of the day is just awful. Like, it starts off not too bad. You're kind of like, oh, she hasn't got a great job, but it's, you could live with this. But quite early on, she's forced to take a call from, you know, her boss's wife, who, you know, is clearly treated poorly by her husband. And she's repeatedly asking, where is he? Where is he? And, you know, she's stuck between a rock and a hard place and can't tell her where he is because he's doing something very naughty in his office. And barely a minute after she puts the phone down, you know, she gets this just hideous vitriolic call from her boss, like saying the most reprehensible things down the phone, and you just see the reaction on her face, and you just know that this is like a daily occurrence and she just has to deal with this as a matter of fact as part of her job. And then as soon as she puts the phone down, she doesn't say a word. She just immediately opens her email and starts writing this apologetic email to him saying, you know, I shouldn't have done what I'd done. It's just the whole film, you just get this horrible sense that this is just the wrong place for her to be. Like, it's the wrong place for anyone to be.
But it also feels very much this does happen and probably still is happening. And even though obviously her boss is never named, you don't know what he's called. He's just a type. But after the whole Weinstein thing, we're all very aware of this now. It really gives you the sort of really small day-to-day, the chipping away of how this happens, which is what I found really interesting, that she's sort of observing how the whole office is in collusion to allow this to happen. I don't know what you guys thought of it, but I thought the standout scene was the scene with Matthew McFadden as the HR boss. And when she finally decides that she might just go and suggest that maybe this isn't right, there's this absolutely blistering meeting she has with the HR that just shows you this horrible situation that many of the people who worked for Weinstein and probably are still working for Monster Bosses are in. What did you think, Jack?
I thought it was very clinical in the way it looks at this lady's day. It all takes place in one day, so it's almost like the most depressing day in the life movie you've ever seen. That scene with Matthew McFadden before then, because it is, it's a very slow-paced movie. You know, we see her printing out things and we see her very, you know, pouring out some cereal and stuff like that. And it is, it's slow and it to make a big point. So I wouldn't say that I was enjoying it. I very much found it uncomfortable viewing, but I thought that scene, everything really kicked into gear with that scene. I thought it really kind of like stood as the centerpiece of the movie. I don't think it would have had the same impact if we hadn't taken our time getting there. It's just terrifying to think that people with this power just do command legions of people who will act in collusion for them. You know, I've been missing The Office. I've been missing you guys and being with you. And then suddenly you see like, oh, maybe I really don't want to go back if it's going to be horrible and
I don't make you, you know, lie to people on the phone and shout at you on the phone. So I hope you're not saying that I'm a horrible boss. But it was, for me as well, I think it's just really interesting to show not only sort of this power dynamic that's come to light recently with all the allegations against Weinstein and others, but also just how a woman feels in the workplace, that she has to work harder and longer and be more grateful than her male associates to get to the same place, and that she has to prove far more that she's worthy of it than the guys who are busy just, you know, twanging their breakfast around and they're leaving for drinks while she's still got 2 or 3 more hours to go. I think anyone can relate to this and can see aspects of it in their workplace. You don't have to be working for a Hollywood mogul to sort of relate.
So she works with 2 fellow male assistants, and it felt very much like, as a woman in the workplace surrounded by men, I can imagine people feeling excluded from that group as well. And they did a very good job of kind of maybe not making them, they're not malicious people, but they're still doing something in a way that is making other people feel incredibly uncomfortable.
And they are patronizing and they are entitled and they're rude. And I don't think they in any way think that they are. But that's just that environment has taught them that that's an okay way to behave. You know, not to say that all the men in this are the only baddies. You know, like even the women in this office don't bother to wash up their mug, which seems like such a small thing, but she's there washing up everybody's crockery. And these women come in, they have a chat about how they're sort of, you know, they're not going to get the job that they want. But then they are again, oh, we're higher up the ladder than you are. So they treat her like rubbish in the kitchen and just leave their stuff to be washed up. And it's those little death by a thousand cuts that this whole film is. It's this day that is just exhausting to watch. I just was like, wanted to go straight to bed having watched it, because I just felt like every minute and every hour that she spent doing all of these menial tasks in the hope that she would get a little bit further in this office. I just thought it was excellent. Really, really good.
Yeah. And as well as, you know, this amazing central performance from Julia Garner, who I think is a real sort of star in the making, certainly based on this and her other recent work. That's what makes it so powerful. It just feels so authentic. And, you know, Kitty Green, the writer director, she didn't base this on one specific workplace or one specific story. Is based on accounts from dozens, if not hundreds, of women about their time working in offices like this. And you just have that nagging reminder every time something awful happens that, you know, this has happened to thousands of women around the world. They're living through these exact scenarios, probably to this day, you know, because men like Harvey Weinstein, etc., just held the keys to the kingdom, and it was the only way for them to progress in their careers, or at least they thought. It's oppressive and horrible, but well worth watching.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things is that Kitty Green, before this, she only really did documentaries like Casting John Bennett, which went onto Netflix. And you can see the kind of clinical approach in this, because it feels almost like a documentary. And even though it's not based on one case and that it's based on all these cases, it gives the film like a universal feel, like we've seen this kind of behavior in offices everywhere. And I guess that's just very upsetting, as is the whole film, really.
It's a companion piece to Bombshell, I suppose, in as much as it just shows you that sort of insidious way that this can happen. And the fact that from, you know, someone as powerful as a news anchor at Fox News to the girl that is literally throwing stuff out in the bins is subject to this sort of thing in various different organizations. It's a film that might be very enlightening to some people who may not be aware of it, but just it feels kind of an important film that everybody should really see. So are we recommending this as a lockdown watch?
I'm unsure, just because I feel like it's a depressing reminder of perhaps what many people will be going back to, you know, and life's already quite sad as it is with the country on lockdown. And so I'm not sure it's quite the feel-good movie we need right now. I think if it had come out without all this going on, all this waving my arms around, then it would have been an important movie that I would say people should go see. But at the moment, you know, it's not the kind of thing you just want to put on the telly.
Yeah, it's not going to cheer you up. What about you, Jordan? Would you recommend it?
I'd highly recommend it. I think it's exactly the type of film that people should be seeking out while they're stuck in their houses. I think these are the type of films that, you know, are often underseen at cinemas just because not enough cinemas show them. And this is a real opportunity for a film that deserves an audience.
And also, let's not forget, there's a weird, just very brief Patrick Wilson cameo that's just in there.
He likes to pop up in things. I remember his episode of Girls was really great. He's a seal of quality when he appears in your film.
Watch out for him. Okay, let's recommend that, but obviously trigger warnings if you are working in a horrific situation at work and you're not looking forward to going back, maybe don't seek it out. But it is available across all platforms from tomorrow, Friday the 1st of May. Okay, shall we move on to something a little bit more bright and poppy and glamorous? Shall we go from the Hollywood of today to the Hollywood of yesteryear?
Rolling!
If we change the way that movies are made,
Coffee, Miss Lala?
I think you can change the world. I want you to be the star.
Really? If you want something, you have to declare it.
I'll do anything.
I am not just a star. I am a star maker.
All right, everyone, roll camera!
Studio is risking everything.
We're already seeing pushback.
So, Jack, set this up. This is Ryan Murphy's new show. He had a whopping great paycheck from Netflix to produce shows for them. This is one of the first out of the gate. What's it about?
He's already had The Politician on Netflix, and now comes Hollywood, which is set just post-World War II and follows a colourful cast of characters as they try and break into Hollywood. Mainly we follow David Corenswet's Jack Castello, who is a young man. He's just married. He's expecting babies on the way. He's not making any money. He's a former soldier, and he starts working for this gas station.
The Golden Tip.
The Golden Tip that doesn't just do gas.
Yeah. Yes. I was quite surprised at this because I thought it was going to be the heyday of Hollywood and sort of going through all of the sort of classic sort of tales we've heard before. But actually, it's a sort of weird mix of fantasy and reality, mixing the two together so you don't really know what was truthful and what wasn't. And it's a lot of gigolos, isn't it? There's a lot of men taking their white vests off to service ladies and gentlemen, and a lot of sexual acts and a lot of people on casting couches. It's quite saucy, isn't it?
Yeah, not one to watch with your mum.
Not one to watch with your mum.
Yeah, it seems to believe that the only way to make it in Hollywood was to sleep your way to the top, was basically the message I got from it.
Yeah, this was very much different to The Assistant in that light, where The Assistant was very much, you know, a clinical dissection of how awful that is. And then this was, oh, you should all sleep with older people and that will get you a casting and stuff like that.
People seem to do it quite happily. Like, you know, you need to sleep with random people for $100 in order to make money and also get a screen test. And very little kind of moral umming and ahhing about that, is there? They're just off they go and they do it.
I watched two episodes, and within those two episodes, there was really very little questioning of the morals of that. It was very much kind of like fun Hollywood. It's a very like camp series. There's a lot of, you know, like, darlings, we're in Hollywood. and it's, it's very Ryan Murphy. That's fun. I think coming off The Assistant after watching that, it was slightly like, is this, you know, right? But, it, you know, take it away from that context, and I guess it is, you know, a fun show. And I think it is going in a more serious route, because at the end of, you know, episode two, and Jim Parsons' character kind of comes into play, it feels like we're kind of getting to very questionable places and uncomfortable places as well.
I loved Jim Parsons in this, playing this poisonous agent who I'm sure is based on a lot of real people. I thought he was great in it. But I don't know about you guys, but I spent a lot of the time pausing and frantically Googling things that happen in this to see if it was reality or it was in the mind of Ryan Murphy. So, you know, there's this whole incident of George Cukor's, the director's, Sunday pool parties, and they were a real thing. He had a load of young men round to his house and friendships were made. I did a lot of that. So it's sort of weird. It was a bit weird for me to just throw myself into it, because I was constantly wanting to know what was truth and what was reality, especially when you've got sort of Rock Hudson as a real character in it, playing around with all of these fictional characters. What did you think, Jordan?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. The blending of fact and fiction didn't entirely work for me, because I just feel you've got so many interesting stories from 40s Hollywood that you could just retell, and you don't need to embellish them with these fictional characters who the vast majority of them are quite bland and just clearly only there because they're very beautiful. And it's just like, why should I be interested in these people when you've got these incredible true life stories happening just outside of frame? The one thing that I found vaguely interesting about it is that it shares some of the DNA of Quentin Tarantino's film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in that it's sort of a fairy tale retelling of what Hollywood was like at the time, or would have been like if certain things wouldn't have been the way that they are. So you have, you know, this very diverse cast of actors who find success in a way that they didn't or wouldn't have in the 1940s. You know, you have a black man who writes a film that gets optioned and goes on to become very successful, and you have black actors who find success. So there's a certain amount of it where you're like, oh, this is quite nice, because you think, what could have been? But then at the same time, you know, the main character is still a handsome white guy who finds fame by sleeping around. It's a show that really wants to have its cake and eat it in that sense.
But if you are looking for glamour, you know, red lipstick, gorgeous clothes, sunny skies, you know, sort of people driving up to the Beverly Hills Hotel and, you know, having fabulous afternoon martini parties in the suites, it is that sort of escapism, bubblegum world that does provide that sort of hit of easily digestible fun.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's quite for me. I enjoyed the series, and like, it did lead me to like Googling a lot of people, like Anna May Wong. There's a storyline about her, so I was reading all about that. That was interesting. I'm a bit slightly done with all the, ooh, Hollywood's so great, La La Land. I feel like
the nostalgia. Is that what you're sort of, you're not into the nostalgia anymore?
I think Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, that was the pinnacle for me. I loved that movie, and I feel like I'm a bit done with it now. Like, I don't need this very, you know, pop gum retelling of it. And I wasn't particularly drawn to any of the characters, really. We follow this guy, Jack, who, you know, he's got this family, but he's not really taking care of them. Well, he's doing it in a way that's kind of weird, but then he's also, you know, having kind of being taken away with this Hollywood lifestyle and stuff and leaving that behind. And I just didn't really like him as much. I preferred Darren Criss's character, who's a director, and, you know, he's complicated himself. You know, he keeps saying he's half Asian, and yet everyone else is saying he looks white. And there's a lot of questions there about, you know, who makes it in Hollywood. I found him a lot more interesting.
Yeah, agreed. I thought he was the strongest character, but he's not the person we spend the most time with. It's Jack, who is just a bland, handsome chap who looks good in tighty-whities and a vest, and that seems to be his entire role. But maybe we need to watch more of it. We have only watched three, so maybe let's see. This could be a big hit, or it may not. I don't think it's going to reach the levels of Tiger King, is it?
No.
Very unlikely.
Is it The Eddie next week? Damien Chazelle's new show?
Yep.
I mean, that also has, from the trailers at least, looks to have a similar kind of like Hollywood-y feel, but also with kind of more jazz music and also Damien Chazelle's hands in the pie. So I'm super excited about that series. I'm not sure if I'm going to continue with this one.
Okay, well, let us know what you think of Hollywood, which starts on Netflix tomorrow, Friday the 1st of May. Speaking of Hollywood, I know that Jack is obviously very anti-nostalgia, but I'm going to test your brains now. Are you ready for a quiz?
Yeah, let's
ready
go for
as
it.
I'll ever be.
Right, so boys, let's start off. Should we start off with you, Jordan, with number one? The late, great Kirk Douglas recently passed away at the grand old age of what? Was it 99, 101, or 103?
He was definitely over 100. I'm going to go 103. I'm pretty sure he was very old.
You are correct. He was 103. So, Jack, what was Alfred Hitchcock's first American movie? Was it Rebecca, Suspicion, or Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
I've recently been making my way through a Hitchcock box set, so I actually know this one.
Yay!
Well, I say
well,
that.
I will let you know if you do.
Yeah. We'll find out.
I don't want to get this one wrong now. I believe it's Rebecca.
You are correct, it is Rebecca, which he actually is being remade by Ben Wheatley for Netflix later this year with Armie Hammer and Lily James. So good one, well done. 1 point each, boys. All right, back to you, Jordan. In The Wizard of Oz, which I actually watched yesterday, who does Dorothy's house squash when she arrives in Munchkinland? The Wicked Witch of the West, the Wicked Witch of the East, the Wicked Witch of the North by Northwest. Aha! Matthew Leyland set these questions, I must add.
I've got a 50-50 choice there, really. I'm pretty sure it's East.
You are
correct.
It's
been a while since I've... Oh, oof.
Well done.
Thank God.
All right, Jack, over to you. Who is the credited director of Gone with the Wind? Obviously, it went through a lot of shenanigans with people walking in and walking off, but was it Victor Fleming, George Cukor, or William Wyler?
Was it a Victor Fleming?
Correct, it was. There were a lot of people involved in that, but it was eventually on the title card, Victor Fleming. Number five for Jordan. Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn made 9 films together, but which was their first? Keeper of the Flame, Adam's Rib, or Woman of the Year?
I've only actually seen one of these. So I'm just going to guess that. Woman of the Year?
Yes. You guys actually know your stuff. Well done. Okay.
I was lucky.
Jack. Studio United Artists was formed by Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, W.D. Griffiths, and who? Was it Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Douglas Fairbanks Sr., or Kirk Douglas?
Well, I imagine it's not Kirk Douglas.
Even though he was as old as the hills.
I know he's very old, but I'm not sure if he would have been quite, you know, at a level where he was forming studios. Senior or junior? I'm going to go with Douglas Fairbanks Senior.
Correct. Well done. Oh, what's going on here, you guys? Okay, Jordan. In It's a Wonderful Life, George's kids are called Zuzu, Pete, Tommy, and what? Janie, Joni, or Jonah?
It's a Wonderful Life isn't one of my, you know, Christmas staples. I've only seen it a couple of times, and the last time was about, I don't know, 15 years ago probably. So another stab in the dark. Jonah?
Oh, mate.
No. What is it, Jack?
I believe it's Janie.
You are correct. So Jack just goes in the lead there. Over to you, Jack.
I've watched it at Christmas. Damn it.
Yep. Okay, here we go for you, Jack. Who starred in the original 1932 version of Scarface? Was it Paul Mooney, John Garfield, or Dana Andrews?
I haven't seen the original Scarface. I think it was directed by Howard Hawks, but I don't know who was in it. I'm going to go with A, Paul Mooney.
Correct. Good to stabbing in the dark. It's ridiculous. Okay, Jordan, which of these films did not win Best Picture at the Oscars? Going My Way, Gentleman's Agreement, and The Bells of St. Mary's?
This is going way back, isn't it?
Didn't win.
Didn't win, okay. I'm not sure if any of these won or didn't. My Best Picture winning films from the 40s is clearly, my knowledge of that is clearly lacking. I'll go with Going My Way.
No, that did win. And so did Gentleman's Agreement. It was The Bells of St. Mary's that didn't.
Yeah, so, that was complete guess.
Yeah. All right, Jack, final question. Something's Got to Give, Marilyn Monroe's final unfinished film, was a remake of which movie? Was it The Awful Truth, My Favourite Wife, or Penny Serenade?
I have no idea. But I'm gonna use the power of deduction. So Something's Got to Give, The Awful Truth. I don't know if The Awful Truth could give. My Favourite Wife, she could give. Penny
Jack.
Serenade, not sure. I'm going to go with B, My Favourite Wife.
And you're correct. And I also enjoyed your Who Wants to Be a Millionaire style reasoning there. I thought you were going to take a lifeline or phone a friend, but very good. I think you won.
I did watch Quiz recently.
Yes, so did I.
Phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
I really loved it.
Another Matthew McFadden cracking performance. Okay, so Jack's the winner. I hope that everyone listening did as well as you, because you stormed that. I think you must have been Googling like mad through Hollywood, and you've got a lot of extra info in your head. Sorry, Jordan, loser.
Yeah, I need to go and do some reading around 40s Hollywood, quite clearly.
Go and brush up. Okay, so that's all we've got time for. Obviously, there is a new issue out on Friday. Jordan, what's on the cover?
It's the new Ryan Reynolds video game action film Free Guy, which Mr. Reynolds himself was kind enough to tweet about and declared to the world that it's his favourite film that he's ever worked on,
so
which
that
is quite surprising.
Worth reading about. There's also a digital quiz book attached to that, which is all of the questions about the Marvel Universe. So get that. And if you're into your digital remote quiz nights, that could sort you out. And there's also 10% off a subscription with the code INSIDETF at checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. All right, thank you very much for your time, boys. That was a mix of euphoria with Emma, depression with the assistant, and bubblegum pop with Hollywood. Thank you for joining me. Say goodbye now.
Bye.
Say it in your best 40s Hollywood voice.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me.